This will be a shorter class, I'm predicting. A group of verses that in some ways complements what we discussed this morning is what we'll be discussing now. Canto 1, Chapter 6, Texts 11 through 14. What's Chapter 6 of Canto 1? What's that topic? Who's familiar enough with the Bhagavatam to know? Canto 1, Chapter 6. The chapters 4, 5, and 6 are a response to Shonaka Rishi's question about how the Bhagavatam appeared. So 4, 5, and 6 are Vyasa's compiling all the Vedas, ending with chapter 4 where he's experiencing great despondency. Chapter 5 is Narad appears and they have the dialogue about why, of all people, Vyasadeva is feeling despondency, why anyone might feel despondency. And chapter 5, Narada gives Vyasa the reasons and instructs him what to do about it. And in chapter 6, there's the major portion is Narada describing his previous life and how he became Narada, how by compiling, in other words, going back to chapter 5, how compiling the literature that Narada wanted, how he would be benefiting people, which is what Narada wants, what Vyasa wants to do. He wants to serve others. And he will best serve others by being the literary person that he is, by compiling such a literature that simply glorifies the personality of Godhead. So he uses his own life example. Sometimes that's done. Gopa Kumar does that with the Brahmana to explain why the Brahmana is feeling despondent. What should he do? He uses his own life example. Not for self-glorification, but for, because it was practical, for edification. So Narada is doing the same here. And the verses that we're going to read, 11 through 14, is early in the chapter 6. It's Narada has had the association of the sages that were staying at the inn where he and his mother were serving them, and the receiving of their mercy was described, and the qualification of the receiver, Narada. And then they left, and now what is he going to do with what he's received? His mother dies suddenly, abruptly, bitten by a snake, and instantly dies, and here's this little six-year-old boy with no mother, no father, no means of protection, no means of anything. But he has factually taken shelter of the personality of Godhead, and so he doesn't just sit there and cry and feel, oh, why did God do this to me or something. He takes it as the mercy of the Lord, and he sets off on pilgrimage, six-year-old sadhu. Text 10 reads, I took this as the special mercy of the Lord who always desires benediction for his devotees, and so thinking I started for the north. Text 11. After my departure, I passed through many flourishing metropolises, towns, villages, animal farms, probably different than the ones that we know in America, mines, agricultural lands, valleys, flower gardens, nursery gardens, and natural forests. So Prabhupada's purport explains or reminds us that this is in a previous day of Brahma, which is and there were all these varieties of things. Note, it is noteworthy that the pablum that everybody is fed in compulsory education today is a very different picture. What's in the past? Primitive people that had maybe they had stone implements when they got a little advanced, and maybe they did some agriculture, maybe, but they were savages and, you know, practically animals that ate the flesh of wild beasts. You know, that's like, and you go back further and you got dinosaurs. Then you get, you know, slime, you know, protozoa swimming around in a primordial soup somewhere. And that's the picture. And before that is nothing. A bunch of amino acids hanging out somewhere, and some bolt of lightning comes and you get protozoas and amoebas and one-celled entities, and then gradually, that's the picture. Everybody knows the picture. And the archaeologists go looking for bones. They know what happened back then. But Prabhupada's writing, in a previous day of Brahma, the way he writes it is in a previous to the present creation, all this variety of whatever you want to call it, modern life or sophisticated life or culture existed. And as it exists now in some form or another, of course, they may not have had Motown, Detroit, but, you know, they had lanes and they had conveyances and so forth. They had urban metropolises and so on. Mines. Doesn't say factories, but business, enterprise, culture, trade, so on. And the same activities will remain as they are even in the next creation. Many hundreds of millions of years pass, and creation is started again by the laws of nature, and the history of the universe repeats itself practically in the same way. Which makes sense. It makes sense in this way that there's tendencies born of the impulses of the modes of material nature, and those tendencies come out, and living entities have karma, and they're pushed, induced by their karma to do things, to do this and do that. Vedic picture of time is certainly that time is cyclical. And there are various components in that unfolding spool of time that are quite similar to the previous spool of time. Variety is there, but the same basic spool is there. The phrase that's used in the Bhagavatam several places is otam and protam, and it's translated as the warp So the two strands of thread that make up cloth, the ones that go this way and the ones that go that way, and they're interwoven, and that's how you make cloth. And so the material ingredients are that, you know, in time are those two strands. So and that makes fabric. So the fabric of life is made up of the material nature and the influence of time, and you get events. You know, living entities are there, the laws of karma are there, and desire is there, and you get events. And the details are different, but there's essential similarity between this cloth and that cloth. Whether it's silk or cotton or synthetic, it's the weave of thread. Different colors, different patterns. But the same basic thing is there, what's being described. It's not a surprise. The other is very egotistical, which is not a surprise. That says, you know, we're big and they're not so big. And before that, it's, you know, it's egotistical. And whatever effort is being made is to support that, and if anything evidence-wise shows up to the contrary, it disappears. That's how egos work. And that's what Prabhupada writes. The mundane wranglers waste time with archaeological excavations without searching into the real vital necessities of life. So, back to this morning's discussion, Maharaj Parikshit is searching for the vital necessities of life. As Prabhupada stated, he already knew, but he's asking anyways. And he was asking for reconfirmation and blessings to do the right thing. Although he already knew. It wasn't wasting time. He didn't have much. He's not going to waste time. But he wanted the blessings of all those sages. And he got it. In the form of Shukadeva Goswami, sent by the Lord because he was so sincere. He got such a qualified person to answer his question, so he asked the same question again. And boy, did he get the answer. And he achieved spiritual perfection. So here's little Narada, who's also not traveling here and there because he's a tourist. You know, with his digital camera, taking pictures of all the places that he saw so he can send back to his mom and dad. Didn't have a digital camera, didn't have a mom and dad, didn't have any interests. He was interested in the vital essence. So if he was interested in the vital essence, why was he traveling around, seeing this and seeing that? It's described. After getting an impetus in spiritual life, Narada Muni, even though a mere child, did not waste time for a single moment with economic development, although he passed through towns and villages, mines and industries. Well, it does, Prabhupada mentions in the purport industries, but it doesn't say factories. He continually went on to progressive spiritual emancipation. There's value even for a little, in this case, a little boy, but a renounced person for moving here, moving there, and experiencing varieties of life, not so that he can become dirtied and contaminated by worldliness, but to continue in all circumstances of life to search out the essential thread. What's the language of in the Chaturshloki verses of Bhagavatam? Sarvatra sarvada is the Sanskrit, which means in all circumstances, everywhere, in all places and all time, searching for the absolute. So a renunciate can do that, and a grahastha can do that. The form that it takes is different. The essence is the essence. If one wants to advance, sarvatra sarvada, inquiring into the essence in all features of life. Now, why a mendicant is, a paribrajakacharya is recommended to travel and experience different things or see different things, part of it is to avoid getting attached to any part of it. You know, here today and gone tomorrow. So who's going to be attached to it? I remember hearing a lecture where Prabhupada was visiting in Detroit, and it was a time when they had just acquired wherever the previous temple was before this one. Some Bhagavan got a large house, a wood frame house, in a residential area, and there were a lot of devotees living in that house. So when Prabhupada came to visit, rather than stay in that house, they got him an apartment so he could stay for, you know, in a comfortable, you know, more private situation. So Prabhupada was remarking, how would you think if I came to visit here in Detroit and I'm going to be here for less than a week and my whole time was spent making my apartment comfortable and then left? What would you think of Swamiji? Does that make sense? Is that what a spiritual, elevated spiritual personality does? Or recognizing that it's only temporary, that one makes do with what's there and moves on. And this whole life, whether it's a flash or 100 years, it's but a speck. It's but a mere passing moment in the expanse of eternity. And is it our business to try to become the enjoyers of sense gratification through economic development, which is that not like, you know, what material society has a high level of concern about? Making sure the economy is strong, both individually and collectively, and then, you know, what you do when you have a strong economy. You enjoy. And under different banners of enjoyment. And knowing the temporary nature of life, is it wise? And part of the renounced person, duty-wise, is travel. And that was, although he was just small, he had no shelter, he had no place to stay or someone to take care of him, but he was fully dependent upon the Supreme Lord, so he traveled here and there pursuing progressive spiritual emancipation. Then Prabhupada writes, Srimad Bhagavatam is the repetition of history, which happened some millions, hundreds of millions of years ago. At least what Narada did in his previous life of Brahma, previous day of Brahma, excuse me, is hundreds of millions of years ago in its history. Are we interested in history? We're not interested in history for the sake of history, like, you know, digging up bones to see what was going on here before we were here. So we have some knowledge. As an anthropologist may have some interest like that. We have interest insofar as it leads to spiritual elevation, and therefore the topics of Srimad Bhagavatam are those topics which, according to the instructions of Narada Vyas, they're specifically why this is being presented in the first canto, is it specifically to help us understand the process of emancipation, spiritual emancipation, attaining spiritual perfection as Narada did. Therefore, as stated herein, only the most important factors of a history are picked up to be recorded in this transcendental literature. So, there are further details In the Bhagavatam is 18,000 verses, is that right? 18,000 verses. Do you know that there's a Srimad Bhagavatam in the heavenly planets? And you want to guess if it's the same size or bigger? Much bigger. How many verses in the heavenly planets?
200.
Keep going. Huge. Hundreds of thousands of verses in Srimad Bhagavatam. They have big bookshelves. And there's just more detail. So the essence of those details have been presented, and there's more detail and more detail and more detail and more detail. Narada continues, I passed through hills and mountains full of reservoirs of various minerals like gold, silver, and copper, and through tracts of land with reservoirs of water filled with beautiful lotus flowers fit for the denizens of heaven, decorated with bewildered bees and singing birds. I then passed alone through many forests of rushes, bamboo, reeds, sharp grass, weeds, distinct from the reeds, weeds, and caves, which were very difficult to go through alone. I visited deep, dark, and dangerously fearful forests, which were the play yards for snakes, owls, and jackals. So he's searching for spiritual emancipation. Why is he? What's the value of this? Traveling about as he did. Why is a mendicant's Paribrajakacharya of value? And Prabhupada explains, but essentially it's we have an attachment to matter. We have an affinity for enjoying matter. And so it's not to fulfill the desire to try to enjoy matter in various ways. It's to facilitate detachment. A person who is on spiritual path and is wise will seek the means of detachment that's appropriate for their situation, not make a comfortable place for a temporary accommodation, but seeking ways for detachment from the temporary so that more energy can go to the attachment to the eternal. And even while dealing with the temporary that's appropriate and necessary, again, the spirit of detachment is important throughout the whole of spiritual life. And a detachment doesn't mean I don't care or be neglectful or be irresponsible. It's not. A Vaishnava is just the opposite, is most responsible. But in the spirit of detachment. I forget exactly where I was. It was somewhere where someone was like really stuck on it. What's detachment? Is it possible to really? Oh, I remember where it was. Was it Intel? Is it really possible to be detached? Or, you know, is that detachment, the real detachment, just kind of like oblivion? So that's an impersonal notion. Just everything is zero. But that's not the notion. It's not the spirit of detachment as Bhagavad Gita teaches it and the Bhagavatam teaches it, or as Narada is doing. He's continuing to go to these various places in the mood of detachment. And we can cultivate the same. And it's detachment doesn't just mean, you know, the renounced order. The cultivation of detachment is for all orders. It cultivation of attachment to Krishna is detachment is a byproduct of that. And when one is detached from matter, one is not less dutiful, one is more Krishna conscious. One does what one does for Krishna, which is the essence of the spirit of detachment. You follow? Let's say there's an attached materialist. What does he want? Money, 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 money. And he's attached. And then, you know, the money goes up and he's happy, and money goes down and he's unhappy, and the money goes this way and he's chasing after money, which is chanchala. Sometimes, sometimes not. And the devotee is attached or striving to be attached to Krishna, eternal. So what's changing about eternal? Nothing's changing about eternal. So it's a position of happiness. And because we're serving the Supreme Eternal, there's this facility for serving the Supreme Eternal when there's plentiful, and there's that facility when there's less than plentiful. And it's just various arrangements for service to Krishna. The happiness level is in service to Krishna, so it's unwavering. And one is not less diligent, more diligent, depending upon abundance and scarcity. It's service to Krishna, service to Krishna. There's steadiness and happiness. And because it's for Krishna, it should be done best possible way. It's far better. The best possible way is far better than sense gratification, if it's done genuinely in devotion. One example is cooking. You know, the fastidious gourmet wants, you know, the finest of taste, something, 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 and they'll go out of their way for varieties of experiencing that. But the Vaishnava, they want to please Krishna. And because someone wants to please Krishna, they prepare such so carefully. And the satisfaction of the person who accepts the remnants of what's been offered to Krishna is far more than the refinement of the ingredients. It's the bhakti. A nice example of this just happened. Again, when visiting in Sharanagati, Mother Jamuna was participating in this japa retreat. And I had brought some mahaprasadam from the Chicago temple, and it was distributing, so I made sure that she, Dina Tarani, got some mahaprasadam from the temple. And Jamuna lit up like, you know, she said several things. She said, "This was wonderful." And she was then describing the wonderful quality of the prasadam that she had taken, and kept saying it in different ways. "You know, please give my regards to the cook who prepared this wonderful prasadam. It was this and that and that and this. It was so nice." She wasn't, it wasn't just like, you know, gourmet tasting nice food. She was appreciating the devotion. And with the devotion comes excellence of execution. Yes? It's like when you have two pockets, and one pocket is your own money and another pocket is somebody else's money. You're going to be more careful with somebody else's money because it's somebody else's money. For yourself, it might, this or that may happen, but somebody else's, you're carrying somebody else's money. You're really careful. Yes? How it's used, or make sure it reaches its destination, or whatever is the intention. You're really careful. So what to speak of Krishna's resource? And if that's the consciousness, then wow. Every act, every word, every step, every service that's done must be for Krishna. If that's the consciousness you're carrying, then excellence is the best in all activity. So, searching for that contact with the Supreme through the varieties of ways of experiencing life produces a detachment for the varieties and a deepening attachment to the Supreme. That's for the mendicant. And for the householder, the same principle applies, it's just the application is different in each thing, so that I not become attached let me be extra conscientious, just like this discussion this morning about some area I know I have some tendency to get lost from the essence. Let me pay special attention so they don't get lost from the essence. And as grihasthas, it's easy to form attachment to wealth and the opposite sex and the products of the combination of male and female through children. Very easy to get lost from the essence. Therefore, let me not just proceed with caution, let me take extra measure to make sure. So it's when grihastha duties are done properly, it's a great facility. You're on the one hand not acting artificially, but you're being protected by proper utilization of things. Krishna will protect you in the spirit of detachment, that it's for Krishna. So here purport is, Prabhupada is addressing the role of a mendicant. He cites the section of the Vedas that says that in this age of Kali, the order of sannyas is prohibited. There are five things prohibited. One of them is the order of sannyas, but then he said, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu accepted sannyas. So how is he the example setter when it's prohibited? Because it wasn't karma sannyas, it was Vaishnava sannyas. It was the dedication, yukta vairagya, the dedication of whatever one contacts in the service to the Supreme Lord. And that which sustains and supports that is hearing and chanting. That which, for whatever the ashram, in this case the renounced ashram. In this age, devotional service of hearing and repeating the holy glories of the Lord is strongly recommended. And one who takes the vow of renunciation of family life need not imitate the Paribrajakacharya like Narada or Lord Chaitanya, although they may, that's option A. Or option B, he may sit down at some holy place and devote his whole time and energy to hear and repeatedly chant the holy scriptures left by the great acharyas, like the six Goswamis of Vrindavan. So, grihastha sannyas, Prabhupada used that phrase, you've heard that before. I have created grihastha sannyas. It's like, you know, a contradiction of terms, but it's not. One who is strictly following the regular principles and carefully cultivating the process of hearing and chanting and extending their senses in service to Krishna, particularly this item of producing God-conscious children and not otherwise, engaging in the giving of the message to others. The sannyasis come and sannyasis go, but grihasthas stay, and taking on that service of extending the message of Krishna consciousness to others, that's the formula for Prabhupada's category of grihastha sannyas. Because many grihasthas look at that option and say, not for me. Not for me. You know, three of the regular principles, but that fourth one is not for me. So that the strength comes from hearing and chanting. And with proper hearing and chanting, it's the principle of Bhagavad Gita is the senses, like the tortoise, are extended when there's service to Krishna. And if it's not service to Krishna, they're not extended. Service to Krishna. No service to Krishna. Service to Krishna. So whether Paribrajakacharya or staying in one place, the process of hearing and chanting to awaken and nurture further development of attraction for Krishna, attachment to Krishna, and thus detachment. Hearing and chanting, very, very important. two more verses. No, one more verse. Thus traveling, I felt tired, both bodily and mentally. And I was both thirsty and hungry. So, I took a bath in a river lake and also drank water. By contacting water, I got relief from my exhaustion. Simple. Very short purport, just two sentences. A traveling mendicant can meet the needs of body, namely thirst and hunger, by the gifts of nature, without being a beggar at the door of the householders. The mendicant, therefore, does not go to the house of a householder to beg, but to enlighten him spiritually. Now that's an issue that Prabhupada addressed directly. Here it's very succinct and short, but in the course of being a sannyas traveler, traveling preacher, or a bearer of the message of Lord Chaitanya, persons perceived him sometimes as a beggar. And persons perceive sometimes our outreach work as we were beggars. But Prabhupada was, I remember the situation when Berkeley, University of California at Berkeley presentation. You've probably heard this before, but even today, Berkeley is like kind of an unruly place. It's a great place for preaching because people are searching for alternatives. But during the time when Prabhupada first went there, it was one of the like hotbeds or like incubation chambers for counterculture. All kinds of hippies and all types of people. It was wild. So in one lecture, right in the middle of the lecture, when Indian graduate student stood up, interrupted the class, and accused Prabhupada, "Why have you come here to the West as a beggar?" Prabhupada stopped the class and, right on the dime, blasted the man. He said, "You have come as the beggar. I have come as a giver. Why have you come to America? You tell me why you have come. Because you want to get an education so you get money. You're out with your begging bowl to get money from this wealthy America. I have not come with that purpose. I have come as a giver. I have come to give this transcendental knowledge, which is the alternative for this beggar's life that you've chosen." Whoa. Man didn't have much to say. Not just because Prabhupada was speaking forcefully, but it was true. Why did he leave where he was to come here? You know, to get something. Prabhupada came to give something. I've come just to give this transcendental knowledge. And so a mendicant may, if he is properly situated, is not in that mood of, "Oh, this is a very nice arrangement for me to get my needs taken care of. I'll just visit this place and that place and I don't have to work." But a renunciate does have work to do, the cultivation of their spiritual life and the giving of that to others. And that's back to what I was describing earlier. There's a very natural arrangement between the household ashram and the renounced ashram. That's very complementary. That what is that relationship? What's the relationship? Vaishnava and proper relationship between a householder and a renunciate. You know, there's the Kali Yuga corrupt version, which has been discussed a little bit, but we don't need to expand upon that. And then the proper arrangement. The proper arrangement is even Prabhupada indicated in his description regularly, he had a certain expectation of his sannyasis. And it was not so dissimilar from the position of the GBCs, although the GBCs had the final responsibility, but both were to travel to see that standards were being upheld, that the devotees were chanting properly and following the standards properly. Where there is some discrepancy, to address it by spiritual influence, not with choppers and swords and sticks and clubs, but to give association and bring standards up and maintain standards up and grow those standards further. To give that spiritual value. He was relying upon his sannyasis to do that service for him so that he could sit and do his translation work, so that he would, could continue to lay the road to Krishna Loka for those that wanted to travel on that road through his transcendental literature, to maintain the spiritual standards by spiritual influence, by giving spiritual teaching. And so the grihasthas, who by nature of their ashram are generally, sometimes we have traveling householders also, but generally staying in one place, and then taking part in and supporting the preaching work. But by being in contact with wealth and things that are acquired through wealth, then the tendency for attachment, the tendency, therefore, to become covered and forgetful of the higher purpose, it's beneficial to receive a detached person. And the benefit is not just, Swamiji, give me your blessing so I can prosper more, but so that I can be detached from this covering tendency due to material contact. And the essence I can keep in close touch with as I'm performing my duties as a householder. And both want to do good for the other. The basic spirit of one who's progressive on a spiritual path is they want that their life is of service to others, just naturally, whatever their position. Let my life be something that's of benefit and value unto others, naturally so. And so, although the positions are quite distinct, and the duties prescribed for the two ashrams are quite distinct, there's a very natural, compatible connection between the two. And well-being of both is secured. The grihasthas value the sannyasis, and the sannyasis value the grihasthas in terms of their ability to be examples for all the other people in the world who are grihamedis. And this is how one can live one's life as a God-centered person without all the craziness, the attachment and the anger, fear, frustration, lust, greed, madness that goes with non-devotional life. Here's an example. So the sannyasi can say, here's the teaching, and look over here. Here's the example, and here's a bunch of examples. One can live in family life and be very, very elevated in consciousness. Very exemplary, but not attached, and very spiritually elevated and very wise, and go talk to them. I was sitting in an airport in Delhi one time, heading for Hyderabad to visit and the Hyderabad temple, and while I was sitting in the waiting room, well, even before I was sitting in the waiting room, it was one of those days that the lines were forever long. You know, after checking in, which took about 20 minutes, it took almost an hour just to get through the security gate because there was like a lot of people leaving early in the morning. So there was one person, a young fellow in a line, that was right next to me, and he just kept looking over his shoulder like I was a Martian or something, and just kept looking and kept looking. And finally, we got to the other side, and he was sitting down. It wasn't because I was a Martian. He was interested in spiritual life, and he was asking this question: how can a grihastha? I'm married, and he had some contact with impersonal teachings and teachers, and he was told by them that, you know, because you're married, you know, just forget it. You can't make spiritual progress. Just, you know, hang up your hat and forget it. Said, but, you know, I'd want to make spiritual progress. I don't want to leave my wife and child, but I want to make spiritual progress. What to do? And I started explaining, but as I was explaining, this devotee couple that I know were also going to Hyderabad, and they came through, and they had their tilak, they had their japa beads, and their little boy with his tilak. They came right up and, you know, paid obeisances and smiled. And I said, well, you know, you want to know what to do. I gave you the example, or the teaching, but here's the example. Look at them and talk to them and ask them how they lead their life. And, you know, he has a job, he has a wife, he has a child. But they're very Krishna conscious. It's a living example of what the teaching says in the book that I can explain to you, but there it is. So grihasthas serve as a great facility to assist the sannyasi in giving the message of Krishna consciousness to others by being good examples. Even without sannyasis, you can be good examples for people in the workplace if they don't happen to meet a sannyasi, just by being exemplary. And that being exemplary means attached, in terms of the verses that we're reading, attached to Krishna. And because of being attached to Krishna, there's just certain things that you won't do, certain things that you won't say, certain modes of behavior are just not fitting. They're inappropriate, and they disappear. And those that are appropriate, and so on, that's what your life is. So it becomes an example of Krishna consciousness. You know, off the storybook shelf and into real life. That's a very important service. And then, together, the duty of the sannyasi can be facilitated by the proper execution of duty of the grihastha. Plus, you all have contact with so many people that a sannyasi may never meet. And by your contact with those persons in good Krishna consciousness, some can be attracted to at least being curious enough to experience the message. And then that's another way that the duty of a sannyasi can be assisted and enhanced by grihastha. And now the other way around, that the sannyasi can assist the grihastha in their duties. So you can do diligently, but be assured of continuing to make proper progress, provided the proper association is received to continue to elevate one. And assist in the missionary work with the resources that are supplied in the role of grihastha. The social dynamic becomes really wonderful when there's properly situated grihastha, properly situated sannyasi, and they're not, you know, an embarrassment for this ashram or an embarrassment for that ashram, but it's very genuine and exemplary. It's very, very, very wonderful. For progressive to bring about, the, using Prabhupada's language, the progressive values of life, manifesting it in the world. And the Bhagavatam here is indicating some of those standards. So we have like a benchmark that's not just in our imagination or somebody, not speculative, but a scripturally based standard to go by, to guide us. Okay. I'll end with that. See if there's any discussion.
We got a lot of people out there. My ball. Yeah.
Maharaj, could you elaborate a little more on how can we set example at workplace?
Depends on the workplace. Three things are really basic that are practically universal in any workplace. Prasadam, carrying bhakti. You don't have to say it or do it, you just carry it. It's a quality that one can, that others will be attracted to, although they don't know what it is. And it impacts others. And a third is, it's related to the carrying the quality of bhakti, but it's the qualities of a devotee, qualities of a devotee, like being detached. Like when everybody else is in a frenzy, a devotee isn't in a frenzy. And backbiting, name-calling, fault-finding, backstabbing, blaming, bad-mouthing, and, you know, devotee doesn't do any of that. Instead, their diligent energy is invested in doing their service in a conscientious way for Krishna. Not cutting corners, not cheating, not lying, not, you know, being ethical people, even in an atmosphere where, you know, that's not always prevailing. Just being consistently like that. People notice. That notice results in curiosity. Like, you know, you're different than everybody else. What's your program? How do you remain peaceful when everybody's running around, tearing their hair out, beating each other up? How do you remain peaceful? They'll ask. And then you can, you know, mildly say, depending upon their degree of interest and, you know, the whole work circumstance. In short, by achar, even more than prachar, you can influence the people in your workplace. By right conduct, you can be a little perambulatory Bhagavatam by example setting. This is how a Krishna conscious worker works. And then that essence leads to so many other things. Like, you know, I noticed during your lunch break you go somewhere. Or you're sitting there reading that some little book over there. What's that little book that you're reading? You know, they'll start asking questions. You don't have to, like, you know, in their face. You just, or however it happens, comes out. People are talking about blah, 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 and you're not participating in blah, blah, blah. And, you know, what's the matter? You're antisocial, or what's your program? And, you know, you, depending upon the circumstance, you can respond. And then people that have spiritual interest will come, and people that have don't, they'll keep their distance because you're no fun. You don't talk about the things they want to talk about. But it's unique that if someone is not ego invested, that's very attractive. Although it's, you know, they don't exactly know how to relate to a person like that sometimes. So you can still be very warm and friendly, but it's not... Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his writing in general, in Harinam Chintamani in particular, he describes some of these things of how a householder can not be compromised in workplace and at the same time can be a spiritual influence in the workplace. Like, for example, he speaks about prajalpa. And he gives this, it's not like, you know, a license to do prajalpa. It's, he expresses that for purpose of social politeness, a householder may share what is otherwise just worldly conversation. How are you today? How's your family? And, you know, niceties. Without being invested in that, but just, you know, polite social exchange. Rather than, oh, I can't, you know, talk about that because that's just mundane. You don't get drawn into it like they are, that like that's everything for them. How's your this and that? You know, you ask, you inquire about their welfare. And, you know, your son has a cold or has something. How's it? Not, but like, to take it the other extreme, it's described about Sanatan Goswami that when he was moving about Vrindavan, having no residence, he was fully aware of everybody's everything. You know, how well their crops were doing that year, and if some, there was a marriage in one of the families, or someone was pregnant, or someone at birth had just come, or a death, or all those mundane things. He was in full knowledge, and they knew that he knew, and they knew that he was the father of all the Vrijbasis, and they would come to him with their concerns, and he would address them as part of the bigger picture of what a Vaishnava will do. But it was only in, you know, it was in the spirit of, exclusively in the spirit of service to Krishna, because life is made up of diverse things. So we can engage ourselves in those activities with others, but not, his caution is not with attachment, nor with all of the other mundane conversation that goes on in the workplace about, you know better than I what goes on. What people talk about, politics and sports and their, how they spend their money and what gadgets they bought and oh, blah, blah, blah. But cordial conversation is not prajalpa. Genuinely caring, showing some concern. So staying on that level of mode of goodness without degrading into passion and ignorance while carrying bhakti, it's attractive. It will lead to other conversations. Minimum, when somebody has a calamity, which does happen in life, they'll want to share that with the person who they understand is a spiritual person. It's just natural. And then one can give a spiritual answer. You know, framed in language that they can, you know, digest, but you can do service to the people in the workplace. It starts with just being Krishna conscious, carrying bhakti in your heart. Waiting, praying to Krishna, please show me some opportunity how I can be of direct service unto you, besides just being Krishna conscious in the workplace. And opportunities will come.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Thank you very much, Maharaj, for very wonderful instructions. Earlier you mentioned in the class that eagerness is very important, the eagerness to achieve the Krishna, to have Krishna is the goal. So, like my capacity or my eagerness is very limited, and how can that eagerness be increased?
You work with what you have. What else can you do? We start from what has developed in our life up to this point, and give it attention. How long does it take for a beautiful garden to grow? It may take years. And that's just gardens, what to speak of our eagerness for Krishna. So you cultivate it with diligence. It will grow. It's just how things work. Gardens grow. And you weed and you add water and sunlight, and it grows. You invest diligent attention, devotion. It grows. Something that you can do, then I'd say two other things. They're kind of obvious, but associate with those who are eager, enthusiastic. Eagerness will grow. Some devotees were describing their book distribution program in Portland. They, you know, they kind of had some interest, but one person who was a real spark plug came along. And the book distribution program has grown and grown, and they're like really enthusiastic through association with someone who's enthusiastic. Turns out he was one of the leading persons in Vaisheshika's program in San Jose. And then his job took him to another place and then to Portland, and now their book distribution is growing just through association. Their eagerness. You know, it's like love to talk about book distribution. That spark became a flame through association. And I would say a third thing is the most important. Of all, the foundation of everything is how we chant the holy name. As eagerness in chanting of the holy name, as quality chanting of the holy name is something that we really value and we work on, then eagerness in all other areas will come. And vice versa. If that's not, the eagerness isn't going to sustain or grow that much. Chaita, Dharpa, and Marjanam, our primary means of purification and elevation is through the chanting of the holy name. So how diligently we apply ourselves to the chanting of the holy name is going to determine how our eagerness will grow overall. And there are resources that we can reach out to and grab a hold of that are that will help our quality of chanting. Anything else? Ladies' side, you've been quiet back there. Anything? Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Since couple of days, this question is bothering me, and I don't know how to ask. But what is the difference between pragalpa and sharing our experience of Krishna consciousness? Like
the difference between pragalpa and sharing our experiences in Krishna consciousness. Well, another term that Prabhupada has used practically interchangeably with prajalpa is gramya katha, village talk. Village talk. Gramya katha. Has nothing to do with spiritual elevation. It's just, you know, blah, blah, blah stuff. Not our experiences in Krishna consciousness, just blah, blah, blah stuff. So, the distinction is, if it's where the like the fire that's within, is the fire, or the, using Dinatarani's word, need, is it, I'd like to share this in terms of relationship with Krishna and my experience of something that happened as I'm going on the path to Krishna in relation to becoming more Krishna conscious? Or is it, you know, I get some relief when my tongue starts to wag? And it just, you know, it's okay because it's in relation to Krishna consciousness, so blah, 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 blah. So it's you know, what's inside the internal consciousness of enhancing our relationship with Krishna. To the degree that that's there, in other words, practically, the same conversation can take place almost verbatim, where one is elevating and the other is just talk. My thought is going to a conversation I had with somebody when, I won't use names, but somebody was going to meet somebody and they were not sure how, you know, the conversation would go, but he said it was real easy because they just talked about themselves the whole time. And it was in relation to good things that they do, but it was in relation, you know, they were at the center, not Krishna was at the center. So it was gratification of the tongue and the urge to speak, rather than let us spend some time together seeing how we can enrich one another's attraction for Krishna and sharing those experiences for the purpose of enlivenment, to inspire one another to go further to Krishna. What's inside, more than specific, in some cases, and what's just the sound vibration.
I have one more.
Yeah.
Thank you, Maharaj. How do we assess our progress within ourselves without comparing with anybody?
Oh, that's a nice question. Let's take the comparing ourselves to other part. comparing ourselves to others' part is a beware matter, because it can easily become offensive without even, you know, before we even blink our eye. It's just like, or competitive spirit rather than devotional spirit. Very easily, just because of our contamination. So best to avoid that. But how we can evaluate our own spiritual progress, here's a few, 1, 2, 3, 4, like basic litmus tests. One, attraction for material enjoyments is diminishing. Or another way of attraction to possess things as objects of material enjoyment diminishes. And that's only possible when there's a growing attraction for Krishna-related service. It's just, It's like those, they have night lights, and when you put your hand over the night light, the thing goes on. Mm-hmm. Or at the light, each night, the light goes out. As soon as you turn the light on, it disappears. So in the presence of light, it's not shining. But in the absence of light, there's this light. It looks attractive when there's... Sense gratification looks attractive when there's no Krishna consciousness. But when Krishna consciousness is awakened, or light of a firefly. You've seen fireflies? So during the daytime, where's the fireflies? Just little bugs that you don't pay any attention to. But when it's nighttime, oh, look at that. Zoom, 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 zoom. It catches your attention because there's no light. But when there's light, it's inconsequential. Like that. That's one. Another is eagerness for association, or particularly opportunities to hear and chant together. It's not just, you know, when a sannyasi or a sadhu or some good speaker comes to town. It's eagerness to hear and chant. That the mind is considering, contemplating how to make arrangements for that. Either in the company of others, or just, you know, that you wish to, more and more, you wish to arrange your day in such a way that there is time for hearing and chanting. Just as opposed to getting more things done, or something like that. Increased attraction for hearing and chanting, and opportunities for that. Like you reset your schedule on a regular basis so that that's there. And you follow it, because there's a growing attraction to see that that's there. And the other things will get done. That must be there. It starts to take a priority. Hearing and chanting, and particularly association. I remember Hridayananda Maharaj describing this from his ocean of experience, that it's a sign that a grihastha is doing poorly when they avoid association of elevated persons. And that's, you know, the other way around is look forward to association. It's a sign of progress, or avoiding is a sign of you're in trouble. You better do something. Another, litmus test is when either austerities like today's Ekadasi, looking forward to Vaishnava standard austerities as because within those auspicious days that are the days when we observe Vaishnava austerities, there's richness of spiritual value. Or the austerities involved in, let's say, going to a sacred place. There's less material comfort, but there's more spiritual value directly just within the place itself, aside from the spiritual activity. So one does not mind austerities. One appreciates not just the austerity in and of itself, but the spiritual value of that auspicious time or circumstance or place, and it invites, looks forward to austerity. The example that's given scripturally is, the Bhagavatam describes that when, as a Kshatriya, becomes thrilled when there's an opportunity for combat and, you know, meeting a challenge, he's thrilled. He gets a strong lashing from a combatant. He likes it. What's the combatant that's just weak and puny and, you know, it's no fun for a Kshatriya? Likes a good lashing. They're not afraid of that. They like that. And similarly, a Vaishnava, a Brahmana, likes austerity. It's not something, oh no, it's the Janmashtami is coming, you have to fast. Oh, Pandava Nirjala Ekadasi. Oh. But one looks forward to those days with anticipation. That's a sign of advancement. And the austerities involved, if one looks upon them as a trouble, that's the other side. Or similarly, when some unexpected reversal comes, where does your mind go? There's a litmus test about advancement. If your mind immediately goes to Krishna, and not like hurry up and make a quick plan so the problem can go away, but the mind just finds solace in taking shelter of Krishna, that's a litmus test. Another is when being tolerant of duality. Like what happens when somebody says something hurtful? Or just like not even necessarily hurtful, but not very thoughtful. Like, you know, a little harsh. What happens to the mind? That's a sign of a litmus test. A person who is advancing remains undisturbed. And a person who's not so advanced, something else happens. Or the other way around, when praise comes, what happens to the mind? And when one is spiritually advanced, it's not, you know, the mind doesn't move. Or it becomes, this is the fruit of mercy that I've received somehow, unqualified as I, you know, just, the mind doesn't go there and take shelter of, yes, yes, more, please. Now I'm happy. Stays undisturbed in the face of duality. And overall, another is steadiness. Whether it's, you know, you're on top of the hill or down in the valley, you're steady. As opposed to, you know, the circumstance determines my enthusiasm level.
Thank you, Maharaj. There's one more last question.
Okay. They're good questions.
What is the advice that you give for a person who is who does not have association, who might stay at home, and all I can do is pray Krishna and, you know, make prasadam and serve the family members, and family members are not interested in Krishna consciousness. So I might be leaving Chicago soon in a month and a half or so, and I'm really afraid to leave the association. It's like the feeling of separation is really getting to me. So I'm not able to really cope with that feeling. How do I continue my Krishna consciousness, you know, with no association in the future?
Where are you going to be going?
Chicago.
You'll find association there.
My husband is not interested, Prabhuji, Maharaj. So that is my biggest...
Well, there are certainly devotees that will offer and receive your association. Now, the situation with husband is a separate topic, but, you know, from this location to that location, association is certainly going to be available. And the challenge of husband or wife not being interested is not, it's not unique unto you. And there's different degrees of that, you know, not being interested, up to, you know, forbidding and, you know, harsh, and not just not supportive, but like really negative. So, in such situations, a lot of Krishna consciousness needs to be cultivated internally. And if you're staying at home and have the opportunity, you know, if you happen to have a telephone, then you can get association that way. There's lots of telephone classes and telephone reading. There's a number of, in Chicago, there's a number of housewives that they have a regular reading program together every day. Every day. As far as I can recall, they've completed teachings of Lord Chaitanya, Nectar of Devotion, and they're in, they, at least the last I heard, they were in the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam. Mm-hmm. And just reading together every day. A little bit. You know, 20 minutes or something. Mm-hmm. But every day. And they pick a time when they know that this and that, you know, they'll have their time. And if somebody misses, they miss, and they have, but there's others that are on the call. How to, it's a whole other, probably not a public topic, of how to address my husband or wife who has no interest. There's a lot of particulars in all of that.
Okay. Thank you, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna. Way in the back there. The bleacher seats.
Thank you, Maharaj. Wonderful lecture. I have a question related to the previous question. What if we don't have any association where we go to for settling down? So what should we do?
For settling down?
Yeah. I mean...
Create association is one option.
Right.
Or stay connected with those from the previous place where you had association by, you know, technology. Phone conference, video conference, et cetera. There's, you know, through technology one can get that kind of association. And when you can, you come, and when others can, they visit, and that kind of association, or come for larger gatherings. where there's like, you know, an ocean.
Yeah, especially when it is hundreds of miles away from, so when the distance is more, so it's not, you know, may not be possible to visit every week.
Yeah, so then you do it periodically, and then your cultivation is through technology, through distant association. But stay well connected, especially with those who are guiding you in your Krishna consciousness, with whom you're most closely receiving guidance, especially, and others.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Okay, thank you, Krishna. Okay, some question back here.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
Sometimes I'm getting so much angry with my family members, and at that time, how can I control my anger?
How can I control my anger?
Yes, I'm not able to chant that time, and I'm getting too much angry. I should control within family members, especially I'm getting with my father, with my husband, with my mother.
You can go live alone. Do you have a sense of where that anger is coming from?
Anger, if any topics, if they, something if I ask, if they didn't do something.
If they ask you if you didn't do something, or if you ask them,
no,
if they
the ways,
didn't.
Both the ways, Maharaj.
Both ways. So expectations of performance that are unfulfilled. But aside from the circumstance, where's the anger coming from? Because, you know, a circumstance like that could be responded to differently. Where is the anger coming from?
From the mind.
Yeah, let's say if they have some expectation of you that didn't happen, good chance if they were to ask you, could you explain what got in the way of, you know, why that didn't happen? You would be able to give them an answer. Well, I had every intention, but instead this arose and that arose and that other thing arose, which I had to address, and I just haven't gotten to it yet. And I'm very sorry. Instead, if they say, what do you mean you didn't do that? What's, you know, wouldn't you rather that they ask you? You know, is there? Could you offer an explanation of what happened? So, because this thing didn't get done. So, if you would like them to do that in relation to you, why don't you set the example and say, when something doesn't, the other way around. Gee, I was thinking that you were going to take care of this, and it didn't happen. Is there something that? What was the difficulty? Familiarity breeds contempt. You've heard that phrase, right? Familiarity breeds contempt. So, for those that you're not in family relationship with, if someone else doesn't do something, because that familiarity dimension isn't there, you may respond differently because you don't have that same expectation or the familiarity. So, and that there's a wonderful antidote for familiarity, and that's respect. By respecting the other person, you can address yourself to a situation, something didn't get done, with respect. Supposing, you know, something that you were hoping that I would do, and I even said I would do, but somehow looks like it didn't happen. You can certainly say with, you know, within all reason, Maharaj, what I thought this thing was going to happen. What may I ask? What happened? What took place? Oh, you have no idea. It was been really tough. Something dupa 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 dupa. That's what happened. Oh, really? Like, just, you know, I made some commitments to some people that I would contact them by a certain time, and then there was a death. I mentioned this yesterday. Whenever, this morning, a 4.5-year-old son of a disciple died, and it was very sudden. And you know, when something like that happens, you just drop everything and you go take care of that situation. And then it was the cremation, and then it was the memorial service, and properly dealing with the relatives, and you know, the grief of the family. And so that just like displaced everything else. So certain things just didn't get done. And I had to explain to people. You know, but there was an expectation that wasn't fulfilled, and every intention was there to... respecting that, the, you know, the good intention of the other person, then you ask. Or just, I'll give another example. Someone that was communicating with me, sending reports on a monthly, weekly basis, it suddenly stopped. And I knew why. I didn't even say to the other person why. Because I knew why. They just like were overwhelmed with stuff that they're doing. And it came up in passing in a three-way conversation where I indirectly let the person know, I know why it didn't happen. And there was something else that was really important to me, and I gave it to them to take care of, and they didn't take care of it in a timely fashion, so I took care of it. And it wasn't like, why didn't you take care of this? Better that you say, I'm just too much to do, and then I'll find someone else that can do this. I did it myself. And it wasn't like, because I understand their situation. And I respect them. So, respect is a good antidote for anger. It puts you in a space of goodness instead of passion. Passion is, I want a result. Kamesha, Krodesha, Rajoguna, some Udbhava. Not just Bhava, but Udbhava. Contact with the mode of passion. So get into the mode of goodness space. When a mode of goodness person will respect others. So out of respect, let me address myself in a respectful manner. There's some idea that I had that such and such, and please share with me what happened. If you approach in that way, you get a much different response. The response that says, oh, I really feel badly. I just, you know, I got distracted, which I don't have a good explanation. But, you know, I'm very sorry. I'll diligently take care of it. If the mode of exchange is goodness, not only, you know, things get done better, and you know, you don't have the bitter exchange that so much time and energy waste goes on when that stuff, it's just a time waster. Besides, it's unpleasant. And the thing that really needs to get done doesn't even get done. And what's more important? That things get done, or we have relationships that are deep and meaningful with one another? When relationships are deep and meaningful, things get done. It's more important. And if there's any issue that arises, it can be addressed if there's deep and meaningful relationships. And if there's not deep and meaningful relationships, a little thing becomes a big thing. Nobody's happy. Nothing gets done. It's all just like, you know, gridlock and finger pointing and blaming. That's not what we want. Respect. And practice voluntary expressions of respect that have nothing to do with the circumstance. I'm giving the same advice to a devotee's son and his mother-in-law. I'm asking the son, every day, pay obeisances to your mother-in-law. And I'm asking the mother-in-law, 3 days of the week, catch your son doing something right, your son-in-law. Express explicitly, I really appreciate this, that is your nature or something you did. And once a week, you can express your voice of correction. She really appreciated the advice. Because she's very wise. And she loves her son-in-law very much. I sort of pat him on his head. But, you know, he does some things that irritate. And she sees it and she remarks. She doesn't remark in a way that's, you know, produces a good result. But it can be done. So respect and respect. And then it's progressive. Because she's wise, and he knows she's wise. Just like doesn't like it when she gets on his case in a, you know, kind of, you know, rough way. He's a good devotee. But everybody needs encouragement. And some correction. And the right balance. There's in Anuttama's leadership class, or seminar, one of the things he teaches is how to offer correction. And there's a very simple formula. You can try it in your home. Appreciation, appreciation, room for improvement, appreciation. It has a nice rhythm to it. You start with appreciation. You repeat another appreciation. You express not bad, like your F, but room for improvement and appreciation. That's, you know, a leader to a follower. So it can work in a family too. But, you know, often, too often, we go right away to the, not just room for improvement, you know, why did you do this? Quickly. Or in other words, you ask question. Was I not, you know, I had this, anyway, you know, you ask questions. In some cases where the relationship permits it, just going, you know, direct is fine. When it's not going to be taken in the wrong way. The golden rule that I shared at the beginning, that's another mode of goodness. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Mode of goodness. It's a universal religious principle. It's not a transcendental principle. It's just a mode of goodness principle. Think if the situation was reversed. How would you like someone to deal with you? Now turn it back the way that it is, and you deal with the person the way that you would like to be dealt with if you were on the receiving end. And cultivate that mode of goodness. Stay in the mode of goodness space and get out of the mode of passion space.
Okay, Maharaj.
Okay. Gave you a long answer. You got a lot of things to work on.
Thank you so much, Maharaj.
Okay, thank you, Krishna. One more question, anyone? Way in the back.
This is a totally different subject, I hope you don't mind. But for prasadam distribution, does everything have to be made from scratch, or how much leeway do we have regarding that?
Okay, this is an administrative, you know, I'm reluctant to go into this territory because, you know, leaders have different policies based upon their circumstances and their resources. Like, you know, let's say Rath Yatra. If it's like massive prasadam distribution, there's one standard rather than detailing it. And if it's like, you know, a home program like this, it's another standard. As far as possible, like say paupers, they're already, you know, almost ready to go. You just like put it on the flame, boom, the next, boom. So often with mass prasadam distribution, a common thing is khichdi, paupers, and some drink. And that's prasadam. But somebody might say, oh, you should make paupers from scratch. And it's possible to do it, but for mass distribution, it's not so practical. Paupers made from scratch are great. I've seen people make them in their home. It's very nice. But we may not do that. It may not be practical. So it's a sliding scale based upon circumstances, like, you know, the particular prasadam distribution venue and the resources. And one may say, oh, we don't want to do that because it's not, so we just can't do that program, that prasadam distribution program, because to do it we'd have to cut corners and we don't want to cut those many corners. But that's, you know, that's an administrative call. Sorry to not detail the answer the way that you might want it, but
no, that's fine, thank you.
At the LA Rath Yatra, you know how many plates of prasadam they serve at the LA Rath Yatra? It's a lot of plates of prasadam. And they do things for the LA Rath Yatra that, you know, my jaw hits the floor. Some of the things that they do for prasadam at the LA, the free prasadam booth. But then they have all the other booths that's not that same thing. But, you know, the mass quantity that they have, and they've got like a, you know, a mega team working for a week just to, because they have a huge refrigerator truck that's there for a week, making lots of noise all night long. I know because I'm staying in the room across the street from it. But, you know, they have to, you know, they at least over the years they've decided we can't survive Rath Yatra unless we do the thing that we do. That, you know, looking at it, I'm not so comfortable with. But hey, I'm not the president of the LA Temple either. It has to run Rath Yatra after Rath Yatra. So it's an administrative call. And so Vasa is very strict, personally. But it's just, you know, it's overwhelming to do the LA Rath Yatra in a different way. So he's made a certain decision. And I respect Sovas and respect his decisions. And I, you know, I would do it differently. At least, I can, you know, sitting over here, I can say that. But I haven't been the LA Temple president for 30 years either, like Sovas has. Okay, thank you very much. Shrila Prabhupada ki jai.